Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, making science and technology accessible, amusing, and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and I'm here with my co-host, John Wells. Today in the program, we're lucky to be joined by someone who knows very much about the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit at the Leonardo in Salt Lake. We'll be speaking with Brighton Sampson. He's the communications director at the Leonardo.
And good morning, Lynn. Beautiful morning out there.
Oh, yeah. I'd hope it just gets a little colder.
Yeah. Yeah. You know how we love to talk about dinosaurs here in Utah? We're going to be speaking with Utah State paleontologist James Kirkland this morning. He's going to take us out of Utah and to Spain, where a recent, very significant discovery put Kirkland in the news again. All this, plus today's cool story, after this. Stay with us.
The Spur Bar and Grill is proud to support KPCW. Located down the alley at 352 Main Street, the Spur is open 7 days a week starting at noon for lunch, après-ski, dinner, drinks, and dancing. The website, thespurbarandgrill.com, includes music schedules, menus, and contact information.
I'll have a blue.
The Egyptian Theater welcomes back Jackson Cash with a holiday tribute to the Man in Black. Friday through Sunday, December 20th through 22nd, Jackson Cash has the look, the sound, and the musical rapport of Johnny Cash. Backed by his band, he plays all the Johnny Cash classics you know and love, plus several Johnny Cash holiday tunes. Tickets are $23 and up and are available at ParkCityShows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Here with me.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, it's not really a mystery, the existence of the Dead Sea Scrolls, because a portion of them are sitting right here. Well, not right here, but in Salt Lake at the Leonardo. It's an exhibit that includes, along with the scrolls, some 600 other exhibits that all are about 2,000 to 3,000 years old. The mystery lies for some in how the scrolls represent the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament, who actually wrote the scrolls, why they were kept in a cave, why such large concentrations of copies of books were in this cave, and what the Dead Sea Scrolls means in the validation of many components from which modern-day religion has morphed. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered more than 60 years ago in a seaside cave near an ancient settlement in Israel called, I think, Qumran. The exhibit runs through April at the Leonardo, right next to the Salt Lake Library. And now the communication director of the Leonardo, Brighton Sampson, is joining us to talk about the exhibit. And good morning to you, Brighton.
Good morning. Always nice to be in Park City.
Well, I'm glad you made it here.
Yeah, that was a little scary. So anyone who's out there on the roads, be extra careful.
Yeah. So you just came up, but was I-80, had it been cleared yet?
Not especially. Once I got past the summit, it got a lot better, but up until that point, it was a bit harrowing.
Yes. Well, we're glad you made it. And last week, John and I went down to visit you. It wasn't so harrowing on the way down, but we went and saw the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. And one of the things that struck me the most is I think that this is really the most important to many people, the most important exhibit that you've had at the Leonardo.
I think that's true in terms of import. I mean, it's been called the greatest archaeological find of the 20th century, and it's really hard to beat that when you consider that these are copies of the Hebrew Bible, almost every book of the Old Testament. And up until the discovery of these, the previously oldest one was about 1,000 years newer than the Dead Sea Scrolls. And even disregarding their significance to the religious community, just the fact that these have survived that long and are still readable in a lot of ways is amazing.
So when were they discovered? What year?
It was 1947. And for anyone that doesn't know the story, it's just the most interesting thing. A young shepherd. The accounts vary, but the popular legend and the one I want to go with is that he was searching for this wayward goat and threw a rock into a cave and heard some pottery shatter and thought, well, there must be treasure in there. And oddly enough, he was very disappointed in what he found. He found a bunch of old rolls of paper with some scribbles on it. So he sold them for a new pair of shoes. And these four scrolls that he found went on quite a journey where eventually the man who had possession of them tried to sell them in a classified ad in the Wall Street Journal because no one wanted them. And again, we're talking about the greatest archaeological discovery of the 20th century that no one wanted.
That's right. He figured those Americans will want them.
Exactly. And he tried to sell them to universities and no one did. Finally, a gentleman from Hebrew University in Israel saw the classified ad and realized what they had discovered. And then the excavations began. And in the end, almost 100,000 different fragments were discovered.
That's phenomenal. And everything, I imagine that during this time in the last 60 years, well, the first 20 of the last 60 years when they were traveling around from here to there, they probably lost a lot of what had been preserved in this climatological, you know, perfect cave.
Exactly. They say some of them were just burned for fuel. They believe that everything's been discovered and gathered up now. I've asked some of the curators, some of the archaeologists who actually were in charge of the excavations, if there's the possibility that there's more out there. And they're like, well, we don't know. There's not a map that says where things are. But it seems like they have discovered everything in that Qumran region.
Since we were kids, we were told that particular lake was called the Dead Sea, or that body of water was the Dead Sea. Mm-hmm. And it shows up on all the maps here in this country. But as Lynn and I both found out when we went down there last week, everybody in the region calls it the Great Salt Lake, which is
right.
And we have a very special relationship, the state of Utah does, with the Dead Sea Scrolls. Can you tell us about that and the involvement of BYU?
Yeah. I mean, the Great Salt Lake to Great Salt Lake thing is interesting too. But BYU, starting almost 20 years ago, was involved with the research and the translation of the scrolls. And they were very heavily involved in the digitization of the scrolls. The first ever digital CD-ROM library was created by the Israel Antiquities Authority in close partnership with BYU and several organizations down there. And now Donald W. Perry and his team, his four-person team, which is the largest Dead Sea Scrolls team at any institution, they've played a major role in the study of these.
Okay. And I wanted to ask you, I forgot what I was going to ask you.
Well, then I'll come up with a question. What do they figure was the climate inside those caves that preserved them so well? It was obviously very dry.
Yeah, it's a lot of conditions. I mean, if anyone remembers, we had the mummies exhibit last spring, and very similar to the conditions that would allow for naturally preserved mummies, allowed these parchments to be preserved. Very dry, very low humidity, still air. You know, you don't want a lot of air currents moving around. And it's still a concern. I mean, if we're not careful with these things, they've lasted 2,000 years, but one wrong move, and they're going to start to decay. And so we've had to turn the heat down and turn the humidity up in the building and keep them under glass and limit their exposure to light. As soon as the museum closes for the day, they're covered up with sheets, and those aren't removed until we open, because even an extra couple minutes of light exposure is going to be a problem.
Wow.
Brighton, did the involvement of the state of Utah have any influence in bringing the exhibit to Utah? Because it's only played in several, I think, nine other major cities.
Yeah, this is the fifth stop on this tour. It's a three-year tour of the U.S., this is the furthest west it's been, and probably the furthest west it will go. And that was a big factor, is BYU's involvement and the relationship Governor Herbert has with Israel as far as trade and things like that.
Okay, so I'm wondering, Brighton, what are the biggest mysteries surrounding it? I mean, you know, a lot of it has to do with religion and validation and of the Old Testament. What do people claim that the Dead Sea Scrolls prove, and is that true?
There's been a lot of, I don't know if it's quite controversy, but there's been interest in how closely what's written on the Dead Sea Scrolls match to, you know, I mentioned the previously oldest version came from the Middle Ages, and they do match up pretty well, from what I understand. And I'm not entirely qualified to speak on the religious aspects of it, but people have asked me, you know, we have a fragment of Isaiah, and they've asked me about controversies between Isaiah in the Book of Mormon versus the Dead Sea Scrolls versus the King James Bible, and I'll leave that to the people that do most of their work on Sundays and to think about the archaeology of it.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of Isaiah, I think there are 23 copies of that book that were found in the caves. So they were really working hard there, copying everything.
Yeah, and it was all hand-scribed, and it's remarkable how good the handwriting is and how straight the lines are.
I want to follow up on Lynn's question.
Oh, sure.
Are you familiar with the Son of God scroll?
I am not, no.
Okay, something I read online, but it's called 4Q246, and they're saying that the literal exactly they say, he shall be called the Son of God, they shall designate him the Most High, for brief years they shall reign over the earth and shall trample on all, and I'm basically painting a pretty clear picture of Jesus. Now, there are controversies because the Jews, of course, were waiting for the Messiah and they weren't necessarily recognizing Jesus Christ. And so, how does that all work out?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I'm not familiar with that particular scroll. There are non-biblical scrolls that were found among these as well. And there is one that describes a battle, a clash between the sons of light and the sons of darkness. And forgive me, I might be wrong in my verbiage there. It might not be sons, but the group of light versus the group of darkness, which does sound very, very much in line with what almost all the Judaic religions or Abrahamic religions believe. It's interesting stuff if you want to go further into that study. And we certainly have plenty of books on that as well available.
So the scrolls themselves are written in ancient Hebrew or Aramaic or?
Mostly Hebrew. About two-thirds are Hebrew. Some are Aramaic. Some are ancient Greek.
Okay. And it is really remarkable how, remember the first scroll we saw, it is so clear. I mean, the ink that was used is still so very clear. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, and I was remarking on how good the handwriting was, and they told me, like, well, yeah, duh, they didn't choose people who had poor penmanship to write them. Like, that's why those people were writing these scrolls, is because if they had good penmanship.
Yeah.
They didn't pick a doctor?
Yeah, exactly. they certainly didn't pick me. Going back to what you mentioned about Jesus, too, the one really interesting thing, besides the scrolls, are all the other artifacts. There is a group of three ossuaries that were found together and ossuaries were the bone boxes. Generally, they'd bury someone and then rebury them a year later when they were just bones in smaller boxes. And the three names are translated into Mary, Joseph, and Jesus, son of Joseph, which is very tempting to think that that might have some greater significance, but it was pointed out those are such common names in that time that just a nice coincidence.
And additional controversies, a number of people are claiming that they own these scrolls, and it's not Israel. As I think in 2010, the Palestinians and the Jordans, or the Jordanians, were trying to get them back when they were in an exhibit in Toronto, demanding they be returned to Palestine.
There is controversy over that. I mean, the exhibit itself steers away from any sort of political connotations with this, but I am aware of that. And at the time that these were discovered, the state of Israel was not the state of Israel. So there are issues surrounding that, which the exhibit doesn't touch on those, but I mean, you're right, there are multiple claimants to the ownership. Currently, they are mostly owned by the Israel Antiquities Authority. There are some in private collections in the United States and some that Jordan has, but the vast majority are housed in Israel.
It must be really interesting to be a docent at the Leonardo during this show. And I have to say that we approached this young docent and just we started off with some really basic question. And he went in, I mean, he was very humble, but his knowledge of the subject, we were stupefied at how much this kid knew. And so that was really great. And then another man approached us and he actually is an Israeli, but he came here to be a docent. And he sort of had that telltale Utah accent, but he was an Israeli at the same time, which was kind of confusing. And there must be all kinds of stories about people who are interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned our docents because they do such a good job. And everyone is working there because they want to, because they're interested in, say, cool science or the traveling exhibits we bring in, specifically the Dead Sea Scrolls. I mean, we had so many applicants, we were able to choose exactly who we thought would be the best fit. Wow. And you just can't help but learn all this stuff when you're there all day.
That's right. Are they volunteers or do they get paid as docents?
There's some volunteers. We have paid employees and volunteers working in the exhibit. So
sounds kind of like KPCW.
Nonprofits, right?
Yeah,
the first
right.
gentleman we talked to, a young man named Matt, he had such enthusiasm. And as Lynn was saying, you know, we started out just asking him, you know, some surface type questions, and we knew this guy could go deep.
Yeah.
I mean, he had so much enthusiasm and so much knowledge. He was it was actually pretty interesting. I want to mention that my expectation was I would see these scrolls when I went there, but they're just pieces mm-hmm. of the scroll. I think in Israel they have complete scrolls.
Some of the scrolls are complete and several feet long, and those are in Israel. Yeah, what we have are the fragments, 10 scrolls in all. In February, those are going to be changed out, and we're getting 10 new fragments in because, as I mentioned, the exposure to light and all that, these are going to go back to Israel and be housed in the darkness for several years. So up until February, this is really the only chance to see these.
And there's also a number of artifacts, including a 3-ton stone from the Wailing Wall that you can pray to and leave messages or whatever.
Yeah, the exhibit organizers didn't intend for that, for the people to leave their notes and messages, but people just started doing it. So now we do gather those up and send them to Israel to be blessed and buried, like the notes that are left on the Western Wall. That's such an interesting piece. That's my favorite piece. It's a, as you mentioned, a 3-ton stone that was excavated. It was believed to have been part of the wall that was destroyed during the Roman conquest. And to be able to just walk up and touch that quite literally gives you a connection to the past 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. And it's hard to put into words that we're studying the artifacts and these things that were owned by people that we'll never know their names or what they looked like, but here's their stuff.
Yeah.
And we can look at it. We can be inches away from someone's comb that died 2,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's my favorite part of this.
It is quite interesting. And also, you know, for those of our listeners who may not be entirely religious, there's still interest for you. You know, we all know the Ten Commandments, and this mm-hmm. is something, part of the exhibit that I found really interesting. So there's this board, and you can press a button according to which commandment you want to hear.
Yeah.
And then it has the scroll that shows all the commandments, and then it gives both the Aramaic, I suppose, or the ancient Hebrew, and mm-hmm. then the English translation.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating. Just really everything about it. Like you said, everyone knows the Ten Commandments. Everyone knows Charlton Heston with his big stone tablets, but to see that actually written down and that people have been following this for over 2,000 years. I get hard to put that into words.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that really makes the fundamental connection that it was, I mean, you know, we were talking about the Ten Commandments. We've known about the Ten Commandments for how many hundreds of years, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But until 1947 or whenever the scrolls were discovered in the cave, there wasn't, you know, the original Ten Commandments were not known to be, you know, where their origin was.
Right.
Is the origin the Dead Sea Scrolls of the Ten Commandments?
Well, these aren't necessarily the original versions of the Hebrew Bible as well. These are copies, and it's believed that they were verbal copies, so people would memorize them, pass them on verbally. So there do exist, well, maybe no longer, but somewhere there's older versions even still that have probably been lost to the ages, but...
Yeah.
What was interesting was that as a young child, you hear the Ten Commandments in there, and they're very short and they're very abbreviated. And then as Lynn and I toured the exhibit, there were some of those were like a paragraph. I mean, they mm-hmm. you know, thou shalt not steal, and then they go on to talk about it. And
yeah.
and that was interesting. Remember Mel Brooks? I'm trying to think of the movie where he goes up to the top. And he comes down with 12 commandments, and he drops 2 of them, and he says, "Ay vey," you know. And
yeah, I think that's the history of the world, part 1.
The history of the world, part
1. Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, 12 commandments.
Yeah. I mean, besides the 10 commandments, too, there's a lot of scrolls that are non-biblical, but are still laying out rules for religion and rules for ceremony. And one of the ones we have says that once you have taken a wife, you will no longer go out with the army. And someone interpreted that as, yeah, once you get married, you don't get to hang out with your buddies anymore. But besides the Ten Commandments, a lot of other rules dictating how you live your day-to-day life in, right. found in these scrolls.
Right, and I'm wondering if, during the exhibit and the visitors who come, can you really get a sense of, Jews, Christians, Muslims, who seems to be the most interested? Obviously, we're a much bigger Christian majority here, but do you get a sense of the visitors and learn a lot about them?
The visitors, it is really varied, and it's... besides just the Christian community, it's just people who are interested in the archaeology of it, in the anthropology, even in the science behind studying them. You're obviously correct that the Christian community does make up the majority here, and they're responding very well to it. We've had the rabbi has been a big part of this from the beginning, and members of the Islamic community have all been involved in this sort of council we've put together leading up to this. And, people don't realize that. The Dead Sea Scrolls do influence Christianity, Judaism, and Islam.
Yeah, interesting.
What is the responsibility of the museum? Are you responsible for carrying certain type of insurance and I'm sure there's specific security that you need to provide?
Yeah, there's a lot that goes into it. Something like this you don't take lightly. Even more so than the mummies, just the preparations of the climate and the building were one of the biggest things. Security, of course. And these were, when they arrived at the airport, there's a police escort taking them straight to the museum. There's a lot of paperwork involved. It's not something I could open up in my attic.
Yeah. Scare you in some ways? Was the Leonardo tentative in any regard?
No, and we were prepared for it. And it scares me if I see someone who's holding a beverage and getting too close to the entrance of the exhibit. And even if someone did spill a drink on the case, it wouldn't penetrate it. But if I see someone with a glass of water and they seem like they're going near the exhibit, I'm like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Back off.
Well, some of those vases and other artifacts are not protected, so...
Yeah, there's a lot of open air pieces in here. Not everything's behind a case or on a wall, and there are several things you can touch,
including a live actor.
Yeah, there is a live actor. I don't know if it's encouraged to touch the live actor, but you probably could if you really wanted to.
Lynn did.
Oh, there we go.
Yeah,
yeah.
What was her name, Lynn?
You're always ratting me out, aren't you?
they're great. We have a group of actors that introduce you to the exhibit to really set the tone. You're not just walking into a fluorescently lit, white-walled room. There's actually sand from the Dead Sea that crunches under your feet as you enter, and an actor sort of portraying the role of an archaeologist in Qumran sets the stage in the present, and then you journey into the past.
Yeah, it's really a wonderful exhibit. I also just want to mention before we go that the pottery, the coins, even some jewelry, as I said, it's 600 artifacts. Is that right?
600 artifacts. A lot of them have never been publicly displayed before. And this collection only exists as part of the traveling exhibit, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Life and Faith in Ancient Times. So it's not like this will be living permanently in a museum in Israel somewhere. Once this exhibit's done touring the U.S., these are going back into storage. And, like you said, the first thing you see is a big clay jar that looks, fairly nondescript. Look closer, and there's a small seal on it that means belonging to the king. So we don't know which king this belonged to or what it was even used for, possibly grains or coins, but this was the king's property. And that's the first thing you see. And then you go deeper into it.
There was another artifact that had a small emblem of an archer, and they were saying that belonged to a man who was responsible for a regent of archers.
Yeah, and they say that's one of the earliest forms of written writing before we had letters and words, or at least in that region, was these little pictographs that they'd use as seals. And the archer is interesting. It's on all of our billboards and all of our printed material. The archer is part of our logo. And when you see it, it looks like a large stone. You see it in person, and it's barely the size of a pinky nail.
Yeah.
And that was used as a signature.
Hmm.
So what are the hours that you are open?
So it's Sunday through Wednesday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., and then Thursday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. And check our website for our holiday hours. We'll be closing early on Christmas Eve, but open late on New Year's Eve and New Year's Day. So,
and you're running through the end of April?
Through the end of April. So the scrolls we have now will change out in February if you want to see those particular ones. But we are here through the end of April. And it's warmer inside than it is outside.
That's right. Brighton Sampson is the communication director at the Leonardo right there in Salt Lake, next to the Salt Lake Library, across the street from the city building on
500 South, 209 West. It's right in the heart of things. And the Leonardo.org has all the information you need, directions, prices, tickets, parking, all that fun stuff.
Very good. Well, Brighton, thanks for braving the storm and coming up today, and best of luck. It's a wonderful exhibit, and I hope all of our listeners make a trip down there.
Definitely. Thank you.
Thanks, Brighton.
And you're listening to Cool Science Radio. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Hi, this is Steve Roney with Prudential Utah Real Estate, a proud supporter of KPCW. With more than 100 sales associates and 14 gallery or ski-in offices in Park City, Prudential Utah can help you with your residential or commercial real estate needs. More information at pru-utah.com or with the Prudential Utah mobile search app.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
3 p.m. to 7 p.m. today, it's The Local View. My name is Randy Barton. I'll be your host if you tune in. Heber Valley Tourism, Rachel Kaler, Visit Heber Valley. She'll be on there at 4:15. Rockin' Riley's, you've seen the sign. Walk on in. It's open for business in the middle of Main Street, 4:45. Park City Meats and Provisions at 5:15. Sponsored by Ramp Sports, Mercer Automotive, Molly Bloom's Gastro Pub, and CNS Creative Services. Tune in.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. We love to talk about dinosaurs in this program, and we've spoken with some of the nation's leading paleontologists, all of whom work or have worked here in Utah. We spoke with Scott Sampson, who discovered the Nasutoceratops last year, and then Randy Ermus from the Utah Natural History Museum, and now Utah State paleontologist James Kirkland. Kirkland's had a distinguished career in paleontology, and for the last decade, he's been the Utah State Paleontologist for the U.S. Geological Survey or Service. He spends a lot of time in the field in southern Utah, and really wherever the correct geology exists to find fossils. Now Kirkland will take us on a little tour of the globe to Spain, to the northeast corner of Aragon, in a town called Ariño, near an open coal mine. Kirkland led the team that discovered perhaps the most intact dinosaur skeleton ever, and he's joining us now to talk about it. James Kirkland, welcome to Cool Science
Howdy.
Radio.
Howdy. Well, first off, I really have to say I didn't lead the team because that was a Spanish project that I was invited to describe the dinosaur. I'm somewhat of an expert on armored dinosaurs. So when they realized they had this animal and another animal that I had some familiarity with, they contacted me. And in this modern world we're in, we basically did this over the internet. It was pretty different way to describe a dinosaur. They hired photographers and shot the bones under my direction, and we sent pictures back and forth. I had to make measurements for me, various angles. They have a good crew of scientists there, but this was one group of dinosaurs that they had no one in their museum that worked on. So it was a great opportunity for me.
Before we go back to Spain, I want to ask you a question closer to home.
Sure.
The Mesozoic era has the Triassic, which is the oldest period. I think it goes back as far as 225 million years. Then Jurassic goes back as far as 193 million years. Then the Cretaceous, which is, I think, 130 million or so. And here in Utah, we have some of the best Mesozoic rock records in the world that contains these three time periods. However, most of Utah's well-known dinosaur fossils are late Jurassic. Will we find Triassic period, those really early dinosaurs, eventually, or will that not happen?
Well, we already have. There was a paper describing a few bits and pieces of Triassic dinosaurs from southeastern Utah, from east of Glen Canyon in the Chinle Formation, which is our Triassic beds that bear dinosaurs. And recently, Brigham Young University has been involved with a very exciting excavation south of Dinosaur National Monument in some sand dune deposits referred to as the Nugget Sandstone that are yielding both beautiful dinosaur skeletons. A whole bunch of them died around a little playa in the sand dunes. But they also have other animals with them, one group of which had been thought to go extinct at the end of the Triassic. So right now there's a debate whether this new discovery is actually either beginning of the Jurassic or the end of the Triassic. And beautiful, complete skeletons of bunches of these very early dinosaurs are being uncovered at this site.
Can you describe the basics of some of these early dinosaurs compared to what we are more familiar with in the Jurassic or the late Cretaceous period?
Well, within the Triassic, the main group we see in the northern hemisphere are coelophysoid dinosaurs. They're lightly built, three-toed, meat-eating animals, fairly slender long necks, fairly long, slender skulls with sharp, serrated little steak knife teeth. A pretty good bod plan for the base of where everything else comes in. The later plant-eating dinosaurs are derived out of this group as well, which actually produces a number of plant-eating dinosaur groups independently through the Mesozoic.
Okay, so James, I want to ask you a little bit, going back to Spain, this they're saying that these skeletons, and there may be more, of very intact dinosaurs are present among these. Well, maybe it's just this one open coal pit mine.
Yeah.
And how much has the, you know, has the opening either destroyed skeletons, or are they so careful about the way that they uncover these fossils or that they dig there that they're preserved?
Well, this coal mine has been worked on for, well, for about 100 years or even more than 100 years. So it's one of the major coal mining spots in Spain. It's possible for a bit of their power there for many, many decades. And as it turns out, these dinosaurs are under the lowest mineable coal. So as they strip the coal back, they would leave, and the rocks are all tilted. They left this big tilted surface in the mine that eventually they would backfill over as they reclaim the mine. They slowly move in an open pit mine. They trench out the coal and then bring in rock, you know, put it over, replant it, you know, have the surface. Well, they were some workers. They were climbing around on this slope and realized that erosion, you know, had cut down into this surface and exposed dinosaur bones. So they called the regional museum called Dinopolis. It's part of the Natural History Museum System of Aragon. And they came out and realized this entire dip surface covering, you know, dozens and dozens of acres was filled with dinosaur skeletons of various sorts, turtles, crocodiles, bits of fish, tons of plant material, a whole ecosystem that had previously been unsampled in all of Europe for that particular age.
Wow. So as a paleontologist, and this may be kind of a funny question, but do you, when you hear about some new drilling operation or an open pit mine where most of us sort of cringe and think about the environment, does a paleontologist go, oh, goody, goody, drill, baby, drill?
Well, it depends on the situation. You know, some drilling operations are actually done for research. Right, just this past month, Randy Ermus at the Natural History Museum here was involved in a research drilling project down at Petrified Forest National Park, where they're quarrying all the Triassic rocks. The Triassic is his area of expertise, dinosaur origins, and they were quarrying them. A big group involved with Lamont Doherty, you know, the Earth Observatory, Petrified Forest National Park, the University of Utah. And this is a research corps, and they're getting a ton of information. They'll tell us about the climatic history of the Triassic at a level we haven't been able to access before. The big thing is if we all work together. In Spain, the coal mine is working with scientists. Often here, there seems to be a little more of an antagonistic point of view relative to science. And that's unfortunate, you know, that we'll stop them or we have the ability to shut a mine down. We don't have that legal ability in this country. So we go with hat in hand. Please, can I see your dinosaurs?
Mm-hmm.
James, I saw this really cool picture of you with a 130-million-year-old articulated, meaning altogether, raptor that was evolving towards mm-hmm. being a herbivore. And
the Falcarius, yeah.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you if you could, well, certainly if you could tell us about that evolution for that particular raptor, but also were there other species that moved towards being plant-eating over time?
Well, you know, in the Triassic, a group of animals, the Ornithischia, appear that developed the same kind of leaf-like teeth, which serrated, you know, the little plications on a leaf are kind of like serrations on a steak knife. They get a bit bigger. Iguanas are modern iguanas, which eat leaves and things, plants. They use it to shred the vegetation. Very simple. They're not chewing things up. But that's the first stage of becoming a plant eater. And all the main group of plant-eating dinosaurs, the Ornithischia, came out of a very early animal in the Triassic, probably in the southern hemisphere, and probably didn't even get to North America till the beginning of the Jurassic. But they radiated into many of our popular horned dinosaurs and duck-billed dinosaurs and armored dinosaurs. But a group of very bird-like animals in the early Cretaceous developed the same kind of pattern. They started developing leaf-like teeth and became plant eaters. They had higher metabolisms. They were covered with proto feathers, maybe even the beginnings of vein feathers, you know, when, you know, this group breaks away from things like tyrannosaurs, which are also have proto feathers. And these proto plant eaters developed a specialized group, the therizinosaurs, which are bipedal animals with, they kept big claws on their hands, probably for defense, maybe to pull down branches, and tiny little leaf-like teeth in the mouth, a big pot-bellied gut. In fact, the gut is so big, they walk around like Godzilla. You know, dinosaurs now, the bipedal ones we know, walk with their backs horizontally. You know, we've changed from the old Godzilla poses. But this group actually developed the Godzilla-like stand-up pose to keep its gut over its hind legs as it shuffled along and pulled plants down. And Falcarius here in Utah was the first, at least the most primitive representative of that group that we have a fossil of, and we have hundreds and thousands of them.
And in the world of evolution, how long would it take for a species to fully evolve to from starting to being a plant eater? How long does that take?
Well, it's never it's not something you put a timetable on. There's certain features of your skeleton you need to do. You need a mouth and teeth that can process plant materials. You need a digestive system, often with bacteria that are symbiotic within your digestive system, to break down plant materials. A gut big enough to handle this. Some of these mutations may happen fairly quickly, you know, in terms of a developmental feature that causes the animal to maybe slow down the development of a certain feature or speed up the acquiring of adult characters early on. So it happens pretty quickly with minor genetic change. Sometimes it's linked to hundreds of small mutations that have to occur. You know, this is one of the fun parts of trying to unravel evolutionary change in the fossil record. You know, everything is different. You know, with us, intelligence is tied to a lot more than blue eyes versus brown eyes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, speaking of fun, James, what is what's the most fun part of your job, and what's the most what's the biggest amount of drudgery that you have to go through?
Well, the most fun part is discovery. Just last April, I celebrated the 40th year of chasing dinosaurs on the Colorado Plateau. Right. And I don't see a bone in a site that doesn't get my heart beating a little faster as I try to figure if it's new. And I'm still, almost everything I find is new to science. Yeah. And that's how it is for everyone here. Utah, we are in the good old days right now. We may not even be at the peak of the good old days here in Utah, dinosaur discovery. But the real drudgery, the thing that frustrates you, makes you want to just jump off a cliff, is trying to raise funding. And that's, you know, we're not curing cancer, we're not feeding the poor. We do excite the public about science, dinosaur paleontology is a gateway science for kids. If you want to keep your kids away from science, keep them away from dinosaurs. We do learn about, deep time, the history of climate change. We see what happens when you have rapid climate change versus slow climate change, how ecosystems deal with these situations. It's the only model we have. We certainly don't want to run large-scale planet-wide experiments if we can avoid it. This is our record, but it is very tough. The funding tracks, once upon a time, things like Discovery Channel used to fund a lot of our work, and mm-hmm. now they buy their programming from small, film companies.
Right. Well, speaking of fundraising and sort of making a case for what you do, all the paleontologists that we've talked to have brought up climate change and how much the past can really teach us about the future. And, I'm wondering if, since we've been talking about climate change in the last, several decades, how you... it may change, the way you present your case to get funding. Like, we study the past, we learn about the future.
It depends on your audience.
and how much money things. They have.
what their interests are. But, it is the only record we have of climate change, is the history of our planet. The scales in which we see... climate change in the past, how fast does climate change happen, what are the effects of warming a region, what's the effects of cooling a region. We've learned a lot looking at the fossil record in terms of, immigration-induced extinction. When you open up migration corridors and new animals come in, what it does to the home ecosystem, in terms of disruption. We've seen a little bit of this because man has introduced lots of animals over the past and plants that have disrupted ecosystems. So, we can look at this, and there's absolutely no question. It is the only way to really look at this is look at the past. If you study the ice ages, of course, you're studying environments that are closer to our own. If you're studying the Mesozoic, it's very different. But part of the reason is very different. You're looking at a super greenhouse world with no ice caps, an oceanic circulation that's warm, saline, and sluggish. Why we got so much oil that comes out of Cretaceous rocks, is we have a sluggish, productive ocean, that buries a lot of organic carbon. These things, we got real data on this stuff, so we know if we start doing this, this is kind of the effects we really need, we'll expect. I mean, we've seen it mm-hmm. happen.
Yeah.
James, there's a 12-minute YouTube video of you online where you take the viewer carefully through what is done in the field and in the lab to bring a fossil to light. And it's extremely time sensitive. I mean, it takes a long time, and not to mention it's hard work, but the mapping and the jacketing, when you put the plaster around it, then you take the plaster off. And so when I see what's involved in harvesting a single tibia, how long does it take to put an entire skeleton together?
Well, generally, I use, just because, I've been doing this 40 years, I've got a pretty good handle on it. When you discover a site to the point where you're mounting skeletons and you're publishing names on new animals, generally you're looking at close to a decade, 8 years, 10 years, but generally close to a decade. We are digging in that film. They show us working on a sauropod dinosaur, one of the big long-necked dinosaurs, a medium-sized long-necked dinosaur. And the excavation of that animal, we think we got it all now, took 3 years. We're still preparing it. And we were working on it in the winters while we were excavating the skeleton out there. We got probably another 2 years of cleaning up the bones there. That's 5 years. We're working with a scientist in Britain. We're working with some other scientists in the U.S. In terms of the description, comparing it against other animals in the world. That's probably another 3 years. And will we mount it? You know, we're looking at maybe using photogrammetry, you know, to create three-dimensional models of the bones using photography. Some of the computer programs to do this stuff are pretty amazing. So we're thinking about trying something really different, basically publishing a three-dimensional set of figures of the animal instead of our regular flat figures, so that other scientists around the world can access the virtual animal.
Now most
that whole thing will take us at least another 5 years, I'm betting.
Now, most fossil finds are mostly just pieces, and full skeletons, articulated, I think is the word you all use, are actually very rare. How rare are they?
Well, the majority, probably more than three quarters of all the named dinosaurs are named from a partial skeleton. When I described Utah Raptor initially, I based it on one claw and some bits and pieces that I couldn't, at the time, I couldn't even tell came from the same individual. Now I realize they are all from the same individual. So we are actually going to publish and expand what we call the hypodyme, you know, the basis for the taxon Utah Raptor. We now have a site for that animal, which you could pretty much hold all the bones in your arm. You know, one person can hold everything from the type. We're now working a site where we have dozens of skeletons, babies to adults, that are working hypothesis is they were trapped in a dewatering feature for the public quicksand. You know, very neat story. It's a pack. I tend to think packs are family groups. We're going to be able to look at the growth history, but these are skeletons. And just around the edge of this 9-foot by 9-foot by 3-foot mass of skeletons, this blob of sand full of skeletons, we have a minimum of a dozen individuals. We've pulled just off the edges 10 jaws with all the teeth in them of babies to adults. Extraordinary sight, but it's going to take us a sky crane. So if any of your listeners have a sky crane, I want to talk to you.
Well, there's been one parked down on Main Street for about the last 8 months.
Oh, man, we need one back. This thing, you know, it's on top of a big mesa. There's the only way to get it off.
Right.
This is probably the most important fossil I've ever been involved with in 40 years.
Mm.
You know, it's an extraordinary thing. It's basically 5 to 7 tons of skeletons in one mass.
I can imagine that is pretty exciting for the likes of you and all of the other paleontologists. And, you know, of all the people we've spoken to on this show, I think the paleontologists are the ones most excited about what they do for a living. It's really pretty. I'm sure if any kids are out there listening, you know, maybe they want to become paleontologists as well.
Yeah, the big take-home message for kids is it is not even close to being done. I know I will never live to see all the stuff I know that's out there, the sites we have that we haven't touched yet, that are full of new things. We have new faunal areas, you know, which you can think of like we have Australia, we have Africa, we have New Zealand out there that we haven't touched yet that are basically new faunas, whole new stories with everything from the plants and the snails and the fishes all the way up through the dinosaurs and mammals are all new to science. And we have several of these things we've already identified, but you can't do it all and do it right. You know, this is how this stuff works.
And James, there's plenty of room there because I think there's only 200 paleontologists in the world, so you know, we need some more.
Yeah, I used to tell people there are more working astronauts.
Yeah, right. Well, and you know,
but the space program and dinosaur paleo.
Yeah.
The fact you can tell kids you got to shoot for excellence is never a bad thing.
That's right. That's right. Now we've talked to all these paleontologists. We haven't talked to our very own resident Park City resident paleontologist. And my buddy, Don DeBlue, who is also a ski instructor here, which just goes to show you that you never know when someone's teaching you how to ski what that person might do for a living.
Oh, Don's my right-hand man. When we get something hanging on a cliff, I send Don up. He has no problem hanging off a cliff and spotting in where, you know, we found the oldest bird tracks out here not too long ago, and they were coming out of a big cliff, and Don roped off, and you know, we found the exact horizon and got the data. But Don's a great man. I also have a fellow by the name of Scott Madsen, used to be a Dinosaur National Monument, that's probably one of the finest micro preparators, you know, getting the rock away from the tiny teeth and very delicate things under a microscope anywhere in the world. So we got some real talent with the Utah Geologic Survey. I'm very proud to call these guys colleagues.
Well, James, thanks for joining us this morning. And when the weather permits, come to the studio and we'll talk again. This is a fascinating discussion, a fascinating conversation. James Kirkland, Utah State paleontologist. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, we also want to thank Brighton Sampson from the Leonardo Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. Remember, that show runs through April. We'll be back in a moment with today's cool story.
Hi, I'm Jan Williams, Program Director. To help share the holiday spirit, we present to you special holiday programming. On Sunday, Cada Domingo presents a festive Latin hour from NPR at 8 p.m. Celebrate the spirit of the holidays with KPCW. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA, 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host, John Wells. Well, that's fun talking about dinosaurs. And how about some other fossils? I found this little cool story for today. It was a fossil of a toe. No, not from a dinosaur, but a Neanderthal person. Oh. Which I wanted to ask James Kirkland about that. About, do they ever come across any human skeletons or, you know, but that was a whole other conversation, I'm sure. They probably come across a lot of other things. But anyway, this toe fossil, it provides complete Neanderthal genome. Now, we've talked about mapping the human genome before on this show, but they're able to extract the entire genome of a 130,000-year-old Neanderthal from a single toe bone that was found in a cave in Siberia. How about that? That's the biggest, newest, greatest thing they've ever any work. It trumps any other work on Neanderthals, and this happened recently.
That's crazy. So they actually have the DNA to be able to construct the entire genome sequence.
Yeah, right. And now Neanderthals have intrigued scientists ever since they were first found back in the mid-1800s. And, you know, there's been some discussion whether they're part of our species or a separate one. And I don't know too much about it, but it's a pretty interesting article. I found this in the New York Times.
If somebody can clone this gentleman or young lady, we would like to have the clone version on Cool Science Radio in the studio.
That's right.
Is that possible?
Could be.
Okay. I also want to mention that tomorrow on Fun Friday, they'll be talking about zoo lights from the Hogle Zoo. That should be interesting.
And thanks for listening to Cool Science Radio. Thanks to our producer, Beth Fratkins, and our underwriter, San Francisco Design, Prudential, Utah Real Estate, and Peak Art and Frame. You're listening to KPCW Park City. Have a great weekend.